Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Bruce Erickson, Managing Partner of the San Francisco office of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. A first-generation American, Mr. Fisher is equally fluent in Spanish and English, having grown up in Mexico. He attended the U.S. Naval Academy, graduated from Harvard, studied at Oxford, and received an MBA from Stanford. Mr. Fisher began his career at Brown Brothers Harriman & Company. He served as an assistant to the Secretary of the Treasury during the Carter administration. He then returned to Brown Brothers Harriman to found their Texas operations. He later created Fisher Capital Management and a funds management firm, Fisher Ewing Partners. From 1997 to 2001, Mr. Fisher was Deputy U.S. Trade Representative with the rank of Ambassador. He oversaw the implementation of NAFTA, negotiations for the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and various agreements with Vietnam, Korea, Japan, Chile, and Singapore. He also was a senior member of the team that negotiated the accords that allowed China and Taiwan to join the World Trade Organization. Mr. Fisher became president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas in April 2005. He serves as a member of the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the Federal Reserve's principal monetary policymaking group. Just today, Mr. Fisher was quoted in the New York Times as describing Fed Chairman Bernanke thusly, quote, "I am tempted to think of him as somewhat Buddha-like. He's developed a serenity based on a growing understanding of the hardball ways the system actually works," close quote. Perhaps tonight we can ask Mr. Fisher to compare this Buddha-like person to the previous Delphic Oracle. Mr. Fisher will speak to us today on inflation and debt, the interaction of fiscal and monetary policy. It is my pleasure to welcome Richard Fisher.
I want to thank you, Bruce, for that introduction. I'm honored to be here this evening. I'm grateful for the invitation to speak to the Commonwealth Club of California. This club was born the same year as my father, 1903. The great transformational brilliance, I think, of this country. It's amazing to me, the child of someone, by the way, who was homeless and begged for food until he was 20 on the streets of Queensland, Australia, to speak to such a distinguished group. And I want to thank you for having me here this evening. Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker, two of Chairman Ben Bernanke's linear ancestors as chairman of the Federal Reserve, have been in the news quite a bit lately. Yet we rarely hear about William McChesney Martin, who was a magnificent public servant who was Fed chairman during five presidencies and to this day holds the record for the longest tenure, some 19 years. Chairman Martin had a way with words, and he had a twinkle in his eye. It was Bill Martin, as he was referred to, who wisely and succinctly defined the Federal Reserve as having the unenviable task of taking away the punch bowl just as the party gets going. He did himself one up when he received the Alfalfa Club's nomination for the presidency of the United States. And I know that your executive director, Gloria Duffy, and others have been to the annual Alfalfa dinner. It is one of the great institutions in Washington, D.C. Once a year, it holds a dinner solely to poke fun at the political pretensions of the day. You can imagine how much they have to poke fun at. And with tongue firmly in cheek, the club nominates a candidate to run for the presidency on the Alfalfa ticket. Of course, none of them ever win. Nominees are thenceforth known forevermore as members of the Harold Stassen Society. And for those of you who are young here, it's named for Harold Stassen, who ran for the presidency of the United States 9 times. And then ran a 10th time on the Alfalfa ticket and lost once again. And the motto of the group is Vini, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I lost. Well, Bill Martin was nominated to run and lose on the Alfalfa Party ticket in 1966 while serving as Fed chairman during Lyndon Johnson's presidency. And in his acceptance speech, he announced that given his proclivities as a central banker, he would take his cues from the German philosopher Goethe, who said that people could endure anything except for continued prosperity. And therefore, Martin declared he would adopt a platform as president that he planned to make, quote, life endurable again by stamping out prosperity. I shall conduct the administration of the country, he said, exactly as I have so successfully conducted the affairs of the Federal Reserve. And to that end, I shall assemble the best brains that can be found, ask their advice on all matters, and completely confound them by following all of their conflicting counsel. Well, Bruce said in his introduction various things about me. It is true I am one of the 17 people who participates in the Federal Open Market Committee deliberations, and I do provide Ben Bernanke with conflicting counsel as the committee cobbles together a monetary policy that seeks to promote America's economic prosperity. By the way, Goethe to the contrary. But tonight I speak neither for the committee, nor for the chairman, nor for any of the good people that serve the Federal Reserve system in the United States. I speak solely in my own capacity. And I want to speak to you tonight about an economic problem that we must soon confront, or else risk losing our prosperity and primacy as the world's most powerful and dynamic economic machine. 43 years ago this Sunday, Bill Martin, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, delivered a commencement address to Columbia University that was far more sober than his Alfalfa Club speech. The opening line of that Columbia's University address were as follows, quote, "When economic prospects are at their brightest, the dangers of complacency and recklessness are greatest. As our prosperity proceeds on a record-breaking path, it behooves every one of us," he said, "to scan the horizon of our national and international economy for danger signals so as to be ready for any storm," end of quote. Today, our fellow citizens and financial markets are paying the price for falling victim to complacency and recklessness, as Martin warned against. Few scanned the horizon for trouble brewing as we proceeded along a path of unparalleled prosperity, fueled by an unsustained housing bubble and unbridled credit markets. Armchair or Monday morning quarterbacks will long debate whether the Federal Reserve could have, should have, would have taken away the punch bowl that lubricated that blowout party. I've given my opinion on that matter elsewhere. I won't go anywhere near it this evening, by the way. What counts now is what we have done more recently and where we go from here. And whatever the sins of omission or commission committed by our predecessors, the Federal Open Market Committee under Chairman Bernanke's leadership is going forward to use a new set of tools to calm the tempest in the credit markets to get them back to functioning in a more orderly fashion. And we trust that the various term credit facilities that we have recently introduced are hopefully restoring confidence while the credit markets undertake self-corrective initiatives and lawmakers consider new regulatory regimes. I'm also not going to discuss tonight present monetary policy, except for to say that if inflationary developments and even more importantly inflationary expectations continue to worsen, then I would expect a change of course in monetary policy to occur sooner rather than later, even in the face of an anemic economic scenario. Inflation is the most insidious enemy of capitalism and prosperity, and no central banker, including me or my colleagues, can countenance it, especially not least the women and men of the Federal Reserve System. But tonight I want to talk about a different matter. In keeping with Bill Martin's advice, I've been scanning the horizon for danger signals even as we continue working to recover from the recent turmoil. In the distance, I see a frightful storm brewing of untethered government debt. I choose the word frightful storm deliberately to avoid hyperbole. Unless we take steps to deal with it, the long-term fiscal situation of the federal government will be unimaginably more devastating to our economic prosperity than the subprime debacle and the recent debauching of the credit markets that we are now working so very hard to correct. You might wonder why a central banker would be concerned with fiscal matters. Fiscal policy is, after all, the responsibility of the Congress. It's not the responsibility of the Federal Reserve. Congress and Congress alone has the power to tax and the power to spend. From this monetary policymaker's point of view, though, deficits matter for what we do at the central bank, at the Federal Reserve. And there are many reasons why. Economists have found that structural deficits raise long-term interest rates, complicating the Fed's dual mandate to develop a monetary policy that promotes sustainable non-inflationary growth. The even more disturbing, dark, and dirty little secret about deficits, especially when they careen out of control, is that they create political pressure on central bankers to adopt looser monetary policy down the road. And I'm going to return to that shortly in my speech. But first, let me give you the unvarnished facts of our nation's fiscal predicament. 8 years ago, our deficit, our federal budget, rather, crafted by a Democratic president and enacted by a Republican Congress, produced a fiscal surplus of $236 billion, the first surplus in over 40 years, and the highest nominal dollar surplus in American history. While the Fed is scrupulously nonpartisan and nonpolitical, I mention this to emphasize that the deficit and debt issue knows no party and can be solved only by both political parties working together. For a brief time, surpluses projected into the future as far as the eye could see, economists and policymakers alike began to contemplate a bucolic future in which interest payments would form an ever-declining share of federal outlays. It was a future where Treasury bonds and debt ceiling legislation would become dusty relics of the past. And the Fed even had concerns internally about how open market operations would be conducted in a marketplace short of Treasury debt. Well, that utopian scenario didn't last for very long. Over the next 7 years, federal spending grew at a 6.2% nominal annual rate, while receipts, what they took in, grew at only 3.5%. And, of course, certain areas of government, like national defense, had to spend more in the wake of 9/11. But non-defense discretionary spending actually rose 6.4% annually during this time frame, outpacing the growth in total expenditures. Deficits soon returned, reaching an expected $410 billion for 2008. That's a $600 billion swing from where we were just 8 years ago. This $410 billion estimate, by the way, was made before the recently passed Farm Bill and before the Supplemental Defense Appropriation, and without considering a proposed patch, as they call it, for the alternative minimum tax, all measures that will lead to a further ballooning of government deficits. In keeping with the tradition of providing rosy scenarios, official budget projections suggest this deficit will be relatively short-lived. And by the way, they almost always do when they look forward. According to the official calculus, following a second $400 billion deficit in 2009, the red ink should shrink to $160 billion in 2010, $95 billion in 2011, and then it swings to a surplus of $48 billion in 2012. Now, if you do the math, as central bankers are wont to do, you might be forgiven for sensing that these felicitous projections look a little bit dodgy. To reach the projected 2012 surplus, outlays are assumed to rise at 2.4% nominal rate over the next 4 years. That's less than half the rate they rose the previous 7 years. Revenue, incoming money, is assumed to rise at a 6.7% nominal rate over the next 4 years, and that's double the rate of the past 7 years. So using spending and revenue growth rates that actually prevailed in recent years, the 2012 surplus quickly evaporates and becomes a deficit, potentially on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, doing deficit math is always a sobering exercise, but it becomes an outright painful one when you apply your calculator to the long-run fiscal challenge posed by entitlement programs. And were I not a taciturn central banker, I would say the mathematics of the long-term outlook for entitlements left unchanged is nothing short of catastrophic. Typically, critics ranging from the Concord Coalition to Ross Perot begin to wring their hands collectively over the unfunded liabilities of Social Security. A little history will give you a sense as to why. President Franklin Roosevelt originally conceived a Social Security system in which individuals would fund their own retirements through payroll tax contributions. But Congress quickly realized that such a system could not put much money into the pockets of indigent elderly citizens who were ravaged by the Great Depression. So instead, a pay-as-you-go system was embraced, making each generation's retirement the responsibility of their children. Now, fast forward 70 or so years and ask this question. What is the mathematical predicament of Social Security today? Answer, the amount of money the Social Security system would need today to cover all the unfunded liabilities from now on, what fiscal economists call the infinite horizon discounted value of what's already been promised recipients but has no funding mechanism whatsoever currently in place, is $13.6 trillion. Not billion, trillion. $13.6 trillion is an amount slightly less than the annual gross domestic product of the entire United States. Demographics explain why this is so. Birth rates have fallen dramatically, reducing the worker-retiree ratio and leaving today's workers pulling a bigger load than the system designers ever envisioned. Lifespans have lengthened without a corresponding increase in the retirement age, which leaves retirees in a position to receive benefits far longer than the designers of the system ever envisioned. And formulae for benefits and cost of living adjustments have also contributed to the growth in unfunded liabilities. Now, the good news is that Social Security might be manageable. While the issues regarding Social Security are indeed complex, it's at least possible to imagine how Congress might find, within a $14 trillion economy, which is the United States, ways to wrestle with a $13 trillion unfunded liability. The bad news is that Social Security is the lesser of our entitlement worries. It is but the tip of an unfunded liability iceberg. The much bigger concern is Medicare, a program established in 1965, the same prosperous year that Bill Martin, as chairman of the Federal Reserve, cautioned his Columbia University audience to be wary of complacency in the storms on the horizon. Medicare was a pay-as-you-go program from the very beginning, despite warnings from congressional leaders. By the way, a man named Wilbur Mills was the most credible of them before he succumbed, as I like to say, to the pay-as-you-go wiles of a woman named Fanny Fox, a stripper called the Argentine Firecracker. But these congressional leaders foresaw some of the long-term fiscal issues that such a financing system could pose. Unfortunately, they were right. I want you to sit tight while I walk you through the math of Medicare. As you know, the program comes in three parts: Medicare A, which covers hospital visits, Medicare B, which covers doctor visits, and Medicare D, the drug benefit that was put into effect just 29 months ago. The infinite horizon present discounted value, the unfunded liability for Medicaid A, is $34.4 trillion today. The unfunded liability of Medicaid B is an estimated $34 trillion, and the shortfall for Medicare D adds another $17.2 trillion. The total, if you wanted to cover the unfunded liability of all three programs, you'd be stuck today with an $85.6 trillion bill. $85.6 trillion. That's more than six times as large as the bill for Social Security. It's more than six times the annual output of the entire United States economy. Why is the Medicare figure so large? Well, there's a mix of reasons. In part, it's due to the same birth rate and life expectancy issues that affect Social Security. In part, it's due to the ever costlier advances in medical technology and the willingness of Medicare to pay for them. And in part, it's due to the expanded benefits, like the new drug benefit program's unfunded liability, which, as I said earlier, is by itself one-third larger than the entire liability of Social Security. Add the unfunded liabilities from Medicare and Social Security together, and it comes to $99.2 trillion over the infinite horizon. Traditional Medicare comprises 69%, the new drug benefit 17%, and Social Security the remaining 14% of that number. I want to remind you that I'm only talking about the unfunded portions of Social Security and Medicare. It is what the current payment scheme of Social Security payroll taxes and Medicare payroll taxes and membership fees for Medicare B and co-pays and deductibles and all the other revenue currently channeled to our entitled system will not cover under current rules. These existing revenue streams must remain in place in perpetuity to handle the funded entitlement liabilities. If you reduce or eliminate this income and the unfunded liability grows, increased benefits and the liability grows as well. Let me say, or let's just say that you and I, and I'll volunteer Bruce Erickson and Gloria Duffy, and every citizen in this country who is alive today decides to address the unfunded liability through lump sum payments from our own pocketbooks. We want to get rid of our current liability so that all of us and all future generations can be secure in the knowledge that they will receive the benefits that have been promised to them already. How much would we have to pay to split that tab? Well, the math is again painful. With a population of 304 million people in this country, from infants to the elderly, the per-person payment to the Federal Treasury would come to $330,000 per person. This comes to $1.3 million for every family of four, which is 25 times the average household's income. Well, clearly, once and for all, contributions would be an unbearable burden. Alternatively, we could address the entitlement shortfall through policy changes that would affect ourselves and future generations. For example, a permanent 68% increase in federal income tax revenue from individual and corporate taxpayers would suffice to fully fund our entitlement programs. Or we could instead divert 68% of current income tax revenues from their intended uses to the entitlement system, which would accomplish the same thing. Suppose we decided to tackle the issues solely on the spending side. It turns out the total discretionary spending in the federal budget, if maintained at its current share of GDP in perpetuity, is 3% larger than the entitlement shortfall. So all we'd have to do to fully fund our nation's entitlement programs would be to cut discretionary spending by 97%. But hold on. The discretionary spending includes defense, national security, education, the environment, and many other areas, not just those controversial earmarks that make the evening news. All of them would have to be cut. In fact, almost all of them would really have to be eliminated to tackle the problem through discretionary spending. Well, I hope this gives you some idea of just how large the problem is. And just to drive an important point home, these spending cuts or tax increases would need to be made immediately, and they need to be maintained in perpetuity to solve the entitlement deficit problem. Discretionary spending would have to be reduced by 97%, not only for our generation, but for our children and their children and their children and all children in future generations to come. And similarly, on the taxation side, income tax revenue would have to rise 68% and remain that high forever. Remember, though, I said tax revenue, not tax rates. Who knows how much individual and corporate tax rates would have to change to increase revenue by 68%? If these possible solutions to the unfunded liability problem seem draconian, it's because they are draconian. But they do serve to give you a sense of the severity of the problem. To be sure, there are ways to lessen the reliance on any single policy and burden borne by any particular set of citizens. Most proposals to address long-term entitlement debt, for example, rely on a combination of tax increases, benefit reductions, and eligibility changes to find trillions of dollars necessary to fund and safeguard the system over the long term. No combination of tax hikes and spending cuts, though, will change the total burden borne by current and future generations. For the existing unfunded liabilities to be covered in the end, someone must pay $99.2 trillion more or receive $99.2 trillion less than they have currently been promised. That's a cold, solid fact. The decision we must make is whether to shoulder a substantial portion of that burden today or compel future generations of Americans to bear its full weight. Well, now that I've lightened the mood in this room, let me come back to monetary policy and the Fed. It is only natural to cast about for a solution, for any solution, to avoid the fiscal pain we know is necessary before we succumbed to complacency and put off dealing with this looming fiscal disaster. Throughout history, many nations, when confronted by sizable debts they were unable or unwilling to pay, have seized upon an apparently painless solution to this problem. It's called monetization. Just have the central bank, the monetary authority, run cash off the printing presses until the debt is repaid, and then promise to be responsible from that point on, and hope that your sins will be forgiven by God or Milton Friedman or anybody else. We know, however, from centuries of evidence in countless economies, from ancient Rome to today's Zimbabwe, that running the printing press to pay off today's bills leads to much worse problems later on. The inflation that results from the flood of money in the economy turns out to be far worse than the fiscal pain that those countries hoped to avoid. Earlier, I mentioned the Fed's dual mandate to manage growth and inflation. In the long run, growth cannot be sustained if markets are undermined by inflation. Stable prices go hand in hand with achieving economic growth on a sustainable basis. And I have said many, many, many times that inflation is a sinister beast. If you uncage it, it devours savings, it erodes consumers' purchasing power, it decimates the poor, it destroys returns on capital, it undermines the reliability of financial accounting, it distracts the attention of corporate management, it undercuts employment growth and real wages, and it debases the dollar. Purging rampant inflation and a debased currency requires the administration of harsh medicine. We've been there, and we know the cure that was wrought by the Open Market Committee under the leadership of Paul Volcker. Even the perception that the Fed is pursuing a cheap money strategy to accommodate fiscal burdens, should it take root, is a paramount risk to the long-term welfare of the United States economy. The Federal Reserve will never let this happen. It's not an option, ever, period. The way we resolve these liabilities, and resolve them we must, will affect our own well-being as well as the prospects of future generations and the global economy. Failing to face up to our responsibility will produce the mother of all financial storms. The warning signals have been flashing for years, but of course we find it easier to ignore them than to take action. Will we take the painful fiscal steps necessary to prevent the storm by reducing and eventually eliminating our fiscal imbalances? Well, that depends on you. And I mean you, literally, the people in this audience. This situation is your creation. When you berate your representatives or your senators or presidents for the mess that we're in, you're really berating yourselves. You elect these people. They serve the will of the people. You're the ones, every single one of you, when you look in the mirror, think about this. You're the ones who let them get away with burdening your children and grandchildren rather than yourselves with the bill of these entitlement programs. And by the way, the issue transcends political affiliation. When George Shultz, who's one of San Francisco's greatest Republican public servants, was director of President Nixon's Office of Management and Budget, he became worried about the amount of money that a Republican president and a Congress was proposing to spend. And after some nights of tossing and turning, he called the legendary Office of Management Budget staffer, a man named Sam Cohen, into his office. Sam Cohen had an encyclopedic memory of budget matters. He had been there from the very beginning, and he knew every zig and zag of budget history. Sam, Shultz asked, tell me something, and let's just keep it between you and me. Here we are in the middle of the night in the White House, and I just have a question between the two of us. Is there really any difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to spending money? Well, Cohen looked at him and furrowed his brow, thought about it for a while, and then he replied, Mr. Shultz, there's only one difference. Democrats enjoy it more. And yet, no one I know, Democrat or Republican, enjoys placing our children or our grandchildren and their children and grandchildren in harm's way. No one wants to see the frightful storm of unfunded long-term liabilities destroy our economy or threaten the independence and authority of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, or tear our currency asunder. Of late, we've heard many complaints about the weakness of the dollar against the euro and other currencies. It's been argued in the op-ed pages of the Financial Times that one reason for the demise of the British pound was the need to liquidate England's international reserves to pay off the cost of the two world wars. In the end, according to that argument, the pound was sunk by the Kaiser's armies and by Hitler's bombs. Well, right now we, you and I, are launching fiscal bombs against ourselves. You have it in your power, as the electors of our fiscal authorities, to prevent this destruction. And the reason I came here tonight is to please ask you to do so. Thank you. And now, in customary central bank fashion, I will do my best to avoid answering any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Richard. Our thanks to Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, for his comments this evening. I am Alex Marin, board member of the Bay Area Council, and I will be conducting the audience question portion of this program. As a reminder, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, who is discussing U.S. fiscal and monetary policy. Richard, the first question, I've had a couple of questions here about a desire to better understand the structure and the workings of the Federal Reserve system and compare and contrast the Dallas Federal Reserve to the San Francisco Federal Reserve.
All right. And I think it's important to understand this. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913 under President Wilson. It's an ingenious, I think, federalist device, in that this was created so that we would avoid the monetary debacles that occurred at the turn of the last century, the penultimate century, so that you had a structure which created seven governors appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the United States Senate, as I was when I was an ambassador and a trade negotiator for the United States, and then 12 operating banks that would operate the payment system of the country, who would be elected by their boards of directors and not subject to Senate confirmation or appointment by the President of the United States, who would be independent. Presently, just so you know, we have five governors, one of whom announced his resignation today to go back to academia. Instead of seven, the Congress has decided not to confirm two of the nominees put forward by President Bush. But we have 12 bank presidents. The system, remind you, was created in 1913. In 1913, St. Louis was the gateway to the West. And so the only two banks in the Western United States are the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, which is led by my good friend Janet Yellen. The fact that things have changed and between us we have a significant portion of GDP doesn't change the apportionment of banks. I doubt any senator would want to give up a Federal Reserve Bank in their state or any congressman in their district. I have the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas as my responsibility. Janet Yellen, as I mentioned earlier, has the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. We operate banks. We lend money at the discount window. We process cash. We clear checks. And we operate as a contractor to provide certain payment devices for the United States Treasury. In the case of the Dallas Fed, I come from a state, Texas, where the use of cash is actually growing, unlike in the rest of the United States. And last year, we processed through the five-story vaults that are underneath my office $121 billion in cash coming in and going out. There are four check processing centers for paper checks, which are disappearing, by the way. My children have never written a paper check. It's a declining industry, and those four are Dallas and the Cleveland Fed and the Philadelphia Fed and the Atlanta Fed. So we operate the payment system of the country. The biggest trading center for the Federal Reserve and the premier inter pares is the New York Federal Reserve Bank. They operate the system open market account to intervene in the system on behalf of all of us. And then all 17 in normal time, 19 in normal times, but presently 17, about to be 16, compose what's called the Federal Open Market Committee, where the base interest rate is set, Alex. And that is done by a process of deliberation. It's unique, I think, in the American government. I've served in two administrations. I've never seen anything so civil. And by the way, I took leave of my senses in 1994 and ran for the United States Senate and unfortunately got the nomination. So I've been through that process. I lost, obviously. I ran with Ann Richards against George Bush and a fine Republican senator. So I've seen all three sides, the legislative, as I call it, the lower intestine, the executive branch, and the central bank. And our deliberations are quite civil. And just to complete the answer, at the beginning of each meeting, the chairman calls the meeting to order. The 12 bank presidents are asked first round what is their opinion of how the economy is proceeding. Each of us gives our views. There's no time limit. We've all learned to be concise in what we say. We're well briefed by our own economists. I have 30 economists at Dallas Fed. Janet, she's so bright she doesn't need any, but she also has an enormous group of economists and advisors. She's a wonderful woman, by the way, a first-rate brain. We go around the table, and then the governors are asked their opinion. The next round is, what are we going to do about it? Do we raise rates? Do we hold them flat? Do we lower them? And if so, by how much, and what's your argument? And then the third round consists of a vote and then a discussion of how we're going to word our statement. We start at 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and we release a public statement by 2:15 on the dot. I defy you to find any place in government that operates that efficiently. And we do it in a civil manner. You're addressed by title, Mr. President, Madam President. We all stick out our chest at that title. It's a great title. You respond, Mr. Chairman or Governor. And it is a civil deliberation. The people in this room know that I have dissented on the last three votes. I've been against the interest rate cuts. But at the end of the meeting, everybody is friends. You know the old definition of Washington. It's a place where a friend is someone who stabs you in the chest. That's not the way the Federal Reserve operates. I think it is perhaps the last deliberative body that is totally civil. And when you're done, you're done. And you embrace the policy going forward. And you proceed to operate your businesses as a banker or do your business as a governor of the Federal Reserve. I hope that exhausts that question, Alex.
Okay. Richard, you have had a distinguished business career in the private sector. You have had a distinguished term of office in the executive branch, and now you are serving in the Federal Reserve System. Compare and contrast the differences of these different areas of service.
Well, I touched on that just now, Alex, so I'll make it short. When I accepted this position, Alan Greenspan said, you only have one obligation, speak to the truth. I don't know anywhere else where you could do that in public policy. Frankly, I don't know, you can't even do that in my own firm, and I was managing partner. Because you were worried about satisfying a customer or satisfying a faction within your firm or being politically correct. I don't ever feel restrained as a Federal Reserve official from speaking what I feel is correct. In my opinion, and I speak only for myself, I don't have to clear my speeches with a soul. The bankers speak on their own behalf, the governors speak on their own behalf, and the chairman will speak on our behalf when he is required to do so. So, Alex, I think that's somewhat unique. As I said, what really makes it unique is it's a civil deliberation, and people are mannerly and respectful. And if you disagree with someone, it's argued at the table. It's an intellectual argument or a practical argument, and there's no retribution afterwards. So I think that makes us substantially different.
Great. So the majority of the questions I would categorize as personnel questions. They mostly revolve around Chairman Bernanke and former Chairman Greenspan. Compare and contrast. Do you have a good story? Why don't you talk to us a bit about their management styles and give us some flavor to serving for those two gentlemen?
You're presuming they're gentlemen.
Yeah.
Okay. They are, by the way. They're great gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you a true story. First of all, Alan was wizened, was older, had been around the block. He had been a business consultant. He had, by the way, I think one of the things that made him unusual, he listened very well because he had played the saxophone for big bands when he was trying to make money as a kid. And you have to get on someone's own syncopation and beat. You have to adapt yourself. I actually think that was a marvelous attribute. At the very last meeting, though, each of us said something to bid him farewell. And I happen to be a fan of Shakespeare, and so I rewrote Henry V's soliloquy at Agincourt. And it was, we few, we precious few, and I changed everything to bankers. When I was done, he said, President Fisher, was that Shakespeare? I said, yes, Mr. Chairman. He said, I went to high school with that guy. That's how long I've been around. So the point is, they both have a sense of humor. Ben has a very charming sense of humor, and he uses it well. I think Ben Bernanke's, as I was quoted in the New York Times today, I want to go beyond that. He is not only prodigiously smart, but I think the best thing that ever happened to Ben, Chairman Bernanke, was that he served on the school board in Princeton, New Jersey. And I'm very serious about that. He was also chairman of the economics department at Princeton. He has, as I said, a prodigious brain. He understands the Great Depression better than any living human being, in my opinion. But what allows him to run a meeting the way he does, with harmony and results, I think was that training on the school board. I ran for the United States Senate. I've negotiated with the U.S. Congress on behalf of a president twice. That's a piece of cake compared to being on a school board or, say, coaching a Y football team. Those are probably the two toughest things you can do as a young person. So the answer, Alex, is both have a sense of humor. Both are quite worldly and knowledgeable. I know that people thought that Ben was too academic at the beginning. You don't go through the kind of crisis we've been through and get the results that we get if you're a pure academic. It doesn't work that way. And I think he has been battle-hardened. I think we've all been battle-hardened by this experience. We found out that the pipes that lead to the sprinkler heads of what I call the great fertile lawn of the American economy, some of them were awfully clogged, or they didn't go to do what they were supposed to do, or the sprinkler heads didn't work. And it became immediately apparent that we had to change our toolkit. Ben Bernanke led the leadership, was the leadership, of figuring out what the new tools would be as we discussed them and debated them and decided what to do. So it isn't just debating the cut in the federal funds rate, the base interest rate that banks lend to each other. It's also restoring the viability of the financial system. And I think his pragmatic hardball approach has been very productive in this sense, Alex. But again, you should always conduct yourself with a sense of humor when you're doing serious work, and both of them have it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, who is discussing U.S. fiscal and monetary policy. Just as a follow-on to that, Richard, do you think that the latter part of the Greenspan administration was too accommodative?
One could argue in hindsight that rates were kept too low for too long. And I'll tell you why one could argue it, because I have argued it publicly. But it's easy to do that as an armchair quarterback or a Monday morning quarterback, as I said earlier. Unless you were at the table, unless you understood the circumstances, the risk of deflation at one point, which is as insidious as inflation. We saw Japan go through this for a prolonged period from 1990 onwards. They're just crawling out of it now. It set them back enormously, the second most powerful economy in the world. I think... It doesn't do any good to go back and say what we did wrong. The real question is, what do we do going forward? And, Alex, I don't know how to answer it any better than that.
Well, there are a number of questions here about prognostication.
That's a good one, since I just did it.
They revolve around what the future has to hold for us, the impact of recent actions on the banking and mortgage industry. Mm-hmm. Is the U.S. headed for stagflation as a way to resolve the financial, budget, and trade problems? Do you agree with Chairman Bernanke that the worst times are yet to come, et cetera, and so forth? Could you comment on that trend of questioning?
Well, I don't think Chairman Bernanke has said the worst times are yet to come. Mm-hmm. At least he hasn't told me that. I do think we are in for a period of anemic economic activity. We, as I mentioned in my speech, we saw a credit system, which is how you allocate capital to small businesswomen and businessmen that depend on commercial paper or borrowing from their bank to operate. Remember, small businesses create jobs in America. That's where jobs are created. That's where adaptation takes place. And we saw a debauching of the credit system. I mentioned that in my speech. So to correct that, it means that those that provide credit, whether they're bankers or other financiers, will be more cautious as they proceed because they don't want to experience further losses. And that's a dampening effect on the economy. people who have experienced their own losses in terms of their values of their homes and what equity they can withdraw from those homes feel poor, and they will consume less. People that feel embattled by the price of food and by energy. And incidentally, the Dallas Federal Reserve does not take out energy and food in our calculation of inflation. Everybody I know has to drive and eat. And particularly important since we are a service-driven economy where the human brain is the capital plant of what we produce in this country. You've got to have food and you have to have energy. But the prices of those commodities have risen significantly. Why? Because we won. What do I mean by we won? The Soviet Union filed for bankruptcy on November of 1989. Mao died. I won't say God rest his soul. Ho Chi Minh is dead. Vietnam, China, the former Soviet Union all want to be like us. They want to dress well, they want to eat well, they want to feed their families, they want to drive cars, etc. And by the way, those that have been their competitors for a long time, like India, now want to do the same. And so they are consuming more, driving up the price of more. It's like gravity. We cannot defy it. We have to figure out how to deal with it. And so, Alex, those higher prices of goods, the inflation that we're seeing coming from commodities and the trickle-down of those forces is also dampening consumption. And I would say that we're in for a likely anemic period. Not necessarily. I don't use the word recession. I've avoided it so far. So far, I've been right. Others who avoid have been right. The first quarter actually had positive economic growth. None of what I call the E-ors expected that, and many analysts projected it. But I do think we'll have a very slow economic cycle for a while these excesses are corrected. Am I negative on the United States? I am not. Part of it's because I'm the son of immigrants, as I mentioned earlier. But I want to come back and reemphasize, you need to do something about what I just spoke about. It is the most important and paramount political issue in America. Don't let a single candidate for any office that deals with Washington, from the presidency on down, address any issue until they answer this issue. How can you dig us out of this hole before you pile on new programs? This knows no party, as I mentioned earlier. But I warn you, if you think what we've just been through or going through now is a problem, it's a minor rain shower by comparison to the storm that's coming, unless we deal with what I spoke about this evening. I'd love to lift your spirits when I speak to groups like that. Go ahead.
And so we have a couple of questions on international matters. The first one is about the role of Basel II and why weren't those new restrictions in place in such a way to dissuade many banks from investing in risky mortgage securities?
Well, I don't want to bore the audience here. It's a general audience. But Basel II has to do with the kinds of accounting guidance and bookkeeping guidance and valuation guidance that's given to banks according to international agreement. And we currently operate under what's known, surprisingly, as Basel I. And the real issue was how you weight and value certain risk assets. And the answer, Alex, is that it wasn't in place. There has been substantial disagreement. And currently, there is some concern about how you value certain assets that may not have a market on any given day, what are called level three assets. But I think going into a deep discussion of that subject, whoever asked the question, I'd be happy to do it privately, but I think it would probably put you to sleep.
Okay, let's stay awake. Let's talk about NAFTA. So, two questions on NAFTA. Do you believe that we can justify the inequities that NAFTA involves? And secondly, how do you remove politics from NAFTA?
Well, you can't remove politics from NAFTA because it's negotiated by our legislators and by our presidents and by our Congress and approved by our Congress. Again, Congress controls the purse strings. Ways and Means is the key committee for the Congress because there are revenue issues involved in tariffs, and that's where the final decision is made to approve a trade agreement or not. Now, I was very actively involved in NAFTA. I'm proud of it. It was negotiated originally by a Republican president, and then a Democratic president closed the deal. And I worked for that Democratic president, and I helped put NAFTA in place and actually make it operate, and I spent 4 years doing that. There is a great economist who I like to go back and reread every now and then, and I would urge you to do so. His name was Joseph Schumpeter. He had a theory called creative destruction. And obviously, when you create new things, you also have to destroy things. Destruction is painful. The creation is what moves an economy forward. And in order to have that function properly proceed, one has to have competition. In order to live up and deal with that competition and prosper, you have to crawl up the value-added ladder and still do better. The idea behind NAFTA was to unify North America from the standpoint of trade and create greater economic efficiencies. It started out with an agreement bilaterally negotiated with Canada. And more typically now, the fearmongers, and I don't mean that negatively, by the way, because destruction is painful. I know. I grew up in a household where my father constantly lost his job. I know how painful it is. Focus mostly on Mexico. And we have image of poor Mexicans streaming across our border, taking away our good jobs. It's an issue that clearly must be dealt with. But I will argue till I'm blue in the face, because I've seen the data, I worked on the transaction, I helped implement NAFTA, that it's a win-win-win situation. And the reason it's a win-win-win situation is it drives each of us to our comparative advantage and greatest efficiency. But again, when you close a factory, or when you have effluents pumped into what we call the Rio Bravo in Texas, known as the river that separates Mexico and the United States, you're going to have pain and negativity. And the oddity of it is that the media will focus on that. When you close a large factory, every news camera's there. When a new job is created for one of those people, dispersed over many new jobs, no one covers it in the press. So it's not telegenic. And I think we have to be very careful, Alex, not to be carried away by passion here, but think of the raw economics. I think Schumpeter was right. Let me give an example. The Transcontinental Railroad, which joined this part of the country, the East Coast. In the old days, you had to sail a ship around the horn. It took 6 weeks. When they put the Transcontinental Railroad through, it took less than 4 days. The cost was driven down dramatically. The shippers complained like crazy, and they protested and demanded that the railroad be stopped. I don't know if there's a person in this room that would argue that we should go back to the old days of not having a railroad that crossed the United States. And Schumpeter said that everything that was considered optimal before is no longer optimal after you, say, take a train and drive it through virgin territory, as he put it. China, Vietnam, little bitty Estonia, Mexico, all these countries that are now participants in the system are a huge Schumpeterian railroad coursing across the global economy, leading to greater efficiency, but also the challenge of competition and job displacement and the painful and destructive side of creative destruction. And, Alex, the answer is we have to figure out, our legislatures have to figure out a way to cushion that blow without destroying the process, provide for adjustment, and we have to continue to drive ourselves to improve our education and move up the educational and value-added ladder to compete. Let me give you some numbers. It's a long answer. 1% of what we produce in this country is agriculture. 5% is mining and oil and gas. 11% is manufacturing. All the rest is services. It comes out of your brain. Software programmers, engineers, architects, lawyers. You may be surprised to learn that there are as many people employed in legal services in America as there are employed in the automobile manufacturing and parts industry. Shake your heads. Lawyers produce twice as much GDP contribution as the automobile industry. That's where we're going. That's where we are. Deal with it. If we don't deal with it, then, and if we try to hold it back and try to protect or try to undo NAFTA, which cannot be done, by the way, then all we're doing is retreating. Let's go back to the pre-days of the Transcontinental Railroad. Let's go back to being farmers. That's not what I think people want. But as I told you earlier, the nice thing about being a central banker is you don't worry about political correctness. You give a straight answer. That's my answer for what it's worth.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, who is discussing U.S. fiscal and monetary policy. Richard, we have a question here about the integrity of government statistics. Huh. Would you be good enough to talk about whether you feel that they government statistics are subject to political pressure, and what do you use in deliberating on statistics in making federal policy?
Well, we have an awful lot of statistics in government. And by the way, going back to my question answer before, we have countless statistics on agriculture and countless statistics on manufacturing. Where we don't have a good measure is the service sector. And where we really suffer from a lack of good statistics are on the impacts of globalization, on the gearing of the U.S. economy, and how it impacts us here at home, and what's going on elsewhere. It's very hard to get a sense from the Chinese numbers as to whether they're actually accurate. Imagine collecting that kind of data over that population base. And I remember one quarter when China reported their GDP the day before the quarter ended. So you can figure that one out. They're getting better at it. The reason I mention that, Alex, is because if you think as a central banker, you cannot think in a closed economy terms. We don't live by ourselves. We share the world with others. Electronic impulses transmit financial data with the movement of a mouse and a click. We are globally integrated whether we want to be or not. It's because of what I mentioned earlier, the fall of the Soviet Union, China's new role, and what I call the two Steves. That is, the fellows that invented the Apple computer. We are interlinked and inextricable. So the answer to your question is, first of all, we don't have sufficient data. Models are built on data. If you model economic behavior using data, data by its nature is historical, which means it captures the past. And the difficult thing for a policymaker is not the past, it's what we're going to do for the future, what inflationary expectations are, for example, rather than what inflation has been. The data that are mostly used are created by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I know the people work to maintain the integrity of that data. I infer from your question that people wonder whether the inflation data is correct. I will tell you that in Dallas, at the Dallas Federal Reserve, as in the Cleveland Federal Reserve, we calculate our own what's called trimmed mean measure of inflation. And what that means is we work very hard, as the whole Federal Reserve system does, and inflation measurers do, to take out the noise and pick up the signal. And when we calculate the trim mean at the Dallas Fed, which is different than the way everybody else in the Federal Reserve System works and guides my arguments in the policy discussions, we'll trim out the most extreme movements from month to month according to a mathematical formula that go up or down and focus on the underlying signal. Let me give you an example. 1 month, 2 years ago, the price of funerals went up dramatically. The price of guns went down dramatically. One could infer that there was some causality there, but I don't want to get the gun lobby upset. But the fact is, they moved to such a degree, we trimmed them out because they were way beyond the normal parameters. And in that way, we work our best effort, sorting through thousands upon thousands of price variables to come up with an accurate measure of inflation. The one thing we know now from the survey data, according to the University of Michigan, is that inflationary expectations are too high. The one thing we can see at the counter at the grocery store and at the gas pump is inflationary pressures now are too high. And again, this is one of the debates we have at the table as to what the right monetary policy and response should be. But I do place faith in the accuracy of the data that we have. The question is the sufficiency of the data we have in a globalized world, and that I think we can always improve upon.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is only time for one more question. Richard, if you had just graduated from college, what direction would you take if you desired an interesting and dynamic life?
Wow.
2 minutes, minute and a half.
This will sound like an oddball answer. First of all, I would have studied liberal arts. I would want to read everything possible, from the Old Testament to the Quran, to good modern literature. And I will answer it in terms of what I tell people that send me their children and always then call me afterwards and say, what the hell did you tell my child? Sorry, we're on the radio. What the heck did you tell my child? I always tell them to go do aid work in Africa, or in the old days, go drive an ambulance in Bosnia, or get a backpack and just sail around the world, because that becomes the foundation of knowledge and experience. And I always tell them not to jump right into investment banking or go to work for a law firm. And I can guarantee you, I can tell you the exact time link it is before the parent calls me very upset at what I've said. But that's my answer, Alex. I mean, look, you and I were at Harvard in the 1960s. We did not look like this. You did, but I did not. And I think the experience that we've had seeing how humans suffer and how they interconnect and how people communicate and how much poverty there is in the world and what success is and why people succeed and what systems work and what don't work. I think that's the most invaluable lesson that young people can learn, and that's what I would urge them to do and take time off to do that.
What would you encourage someone to be involved in public service?
Of course, that's the right answer I should have given. And yes, the answer, and I would encourage anybody who cares about the issues I spoke about tonight and anybody who's fortunate enough to do well, and I'll end on this note, which is a note I started on. My parents came here with zilch. In fact, my father came with no papers and they wouldn't let him in, 1939. So he bopped back and forth across the border from Mexico. No education, nothing. His son went to all these great schools that you mentioned when you introduced me. Imagine that. So I think that's our greatest virtue as Americans, Alex. And I would encourage anybody to think that there is a need to pay back the good fortune that we've received. And I believe that's why everybody in some way, shape, or form, whether it's Ben Bernanke serving either as a school board chairman or chairman of the Federal Reserve, whatever the right appropriate level where you feel comfortable is, you should pay it back, as they say, particularly if you've been blessed with good fortune. Thank you very much for letting me speak here tonight.
Our thanks to Richard Fisher, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Alex Maron, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.